Welcome to The People's Game. This is KPFK Radio, Alternative Radio. We'll be back next week at this time. I am Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
I'm Fernando Romero.
And I'm Pablo Morales.
And we are going to hear across the hour some clips from an interview that was recorded yesterday with Simon Cooper, one of the great international prominent football writers, author of Soccer Against the Enemy, and also author of the most recent his most recent book, Soccernomics. It's actually creating some waves in terms of challenging soccer establishment to analyze the game in a different way. So we'll be hearing a little bit from Simon Cooper across the hour. We're also going to be joined momentarily by Nick Green, he of 100% Soccer, and we're going to start talking about, well, the big event. Everybody in the world pretty much knows what it is. It's the largest collective event that occurs on any one time, shared by humanity, and has been for quite a while, the World Cup Final, absolutely dwarfing the American Super Bowl, for those of you who don't know, by orders of magnitude, or for that matter, any event at the Olympics, Summer Olympics. Of course, the United States has largely been on the margins of this global spectacle in this year, more than ever, including, in all likelihood, 1994, more Americans seem to be paying attention. It'll be interesting to see what the TV ratings are in the United States. But for what it's worth, the conservative estimation is one out of every four people who are alive will be watching this. And that's 1.5 billion. But I've heard that the more accurate figure is a little higher. 1.8 billion people will be watching the World Cup final between Holland and Spain. So across this hour, I think we're going to talk about the game, obviously. Some reflections back on the World Cup, but also about this spectacle and why it is that humanity at this hour of its history pays more attention to this than, guess what, folks, anything else. Okay, So first off, let's talk right away, just in brief, what we expect about this game, because we're going to be joined by Nick Green in a moment. And let's start with you, Pablo. And what are you wearing?
Oh, I've got my Spanish cap and my Dutch shirt. I'm definitely schizophrenic today. it's a win-win for me. If I could have had any team play in the final outside of the United States, in my dream sequence, it would be these two teams. And here we have the Dutch team that hasn't lost in any of the qualifiers and in any of the games. If they win today, they match only the 2002, Brazilian team in doing that. And we have a Spanish team, which is playing probably the most beautiful football that the world has seen in the last half century, probably since the Hungarians, in terms of just beautiful passing and movement. And let's hope for a great game.
More beautiful than the Dutch in 74.
Well, the Dutch in 74 were, I don't think, as technically gifted as the Spanish team this is. You know, there were several people on the Dutch squad in the 70s, which I loved. They were like the first team that I was like infatuated with, who were, you have the Niskins, the finisher, you've got the general in the middle with Cruyff, you've got, but overall, this Spanish team, player for player, especially the Barcelona core, they rarely make a bad pass, they rarely not anticipate a movement off the ball. It's just beautiful to watch, and I've had the pleasure of going to Camp Nou and seeing them in person as the Barcelona squad. And it was like watching ballet in some levels.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that really people who are watching the game, who are relatively new to watching football, soccer, they should keep their eyes open actually for passing. And I think that's one of the things where if you know to watch the art of passing. For the well-placed ball that lands exactly at the square, the foot of the right player, that where you're able to find the brilliant pass in the middle of a chaotic situation. A lot of the art of the game and the pleasure of watching the game is in appreciating that. Pablo, on our way over here, you were actually telling me that there's a lot of sort of a kind of an oversimplification of the story of total football, which is a style associated with the Dutch and where it comes from. And so you were kind of correcting the history of that for me.
Well, I just was I had been reminded recently in reading some old books of mine that, the concept of total football, the concept of players interchanging on the field, it actually comes from Central Europe. Eventually was part of the Magic Magyars of the Hungarian teams, but started in Budapest and the teams out of there in the 30s.
Wow.
And but it, what happened was it never took on sort of a – it was Rinus Michels, of the great Dutch coach, that really made it into a system versus just a style of play.
Ah.
And that popularized it. In the 70s, when television arrived and everyone could see
it,
then it's so much of modern football. The reason one out of four people in the world are watching it, because it's become a television spectacle. And so we can all have this shared experience. Before television, you know, it was hard to, you know, have that communal experience of any kind of a sport, let alone, you know, football or the Super Bowl or whatever you want to use. Sport is perfect for television. It's an event, and we all get to share it.
Well, you one can imagine, too, somewhere around the world back in when the game was developing, some fullback ran down the field and said, I can do this. I'm going to do it regularly. You back there, cover for me in the back, you know. Let's go quickly through Fernando, then Jennifer, and get to Nick. Don't want to keep Nick on hold too long. And Fernando, you're not wearing a Spanish hat.
I am not. I'm wearing my – actually, I've been wearing this for a couple of days while I've been coming to the show. I watched it last night, so it's okay.
That could be bad luck.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm wearing my La Orange number 10 on the back, obviously, and in tribute to Johan Cruyff or Schneider, whoever you want to make it to. But as Pablo was saying, I expect a really good game. I hope we can expect a game like yesterday's between Uruguay and Germany, but I expect a lot of possession from the Spanish team, and I really hope that the Dutch could take it away, and maybe we'll have a game that's going to be going back and forth throughout the 90 minutes.
Well, I'm actually really looking forward to USA versus Ghana on July 14th at noon Eastern Standard Time on ESPNU, which is the United States women's under-20 squad taking the field in their first match of the U-20 Women's World Cup. So we might say that's a grudge match there, given that Ghana is the men's squad. The senior men's squad did knock out the senior U.S. men's squad.
Two World Cups in a row.
So who knows? I know nothing about the Ghanaian women's side, but I'm really excited to see that they qualified for this tournament, because that says something very positive about their National Football Association. The USA then faces Switzerland on July 17th and Korea. And I just want to lament poor Nigeria. Nigeria, they in the last Senior Women's World Cup, I think I'm thinking of the Olympics, they drew just like the group of death, and it looks like they've done it again. And ended up in a group with Germany, I think it's Mexico and Japan. And that's actually Japan. The Japanese women are really strong. So, this is my activist. This is, by the way, to listeners, this is my activist impulse countering the overwhelming weighting of all sports media coverage to men. And all the tiny little insignificant things they do. You're hearing a bit of my resentiment about the LeBron James thing. So anyway.
Where's LeBron going?
Let's not start
there. Well, I do want to say this about Ghana, and that's great. First of all, I want to point out that one of my takes on the USA and the positive effects of having the United States football become huge in the United States, I do think there could be spillover, and that'll be bring more attention to the women's game, because obviously the United States is a great powerhouse in the women's game, and that the developmental system here in the United States is vastly superior than balances of countries. But it's great to see Ghana, because Ghana has a great institutional structure in Ghana, and hopefully that does mean that that's carrying over.
Yeah, and I want to also indicate to listeners that USsoccer.com, which is the U.S. Soccer Federation's official website, they actually really feature the women's game pretty much 50-50, and that's something that's really rare in the world, even for countries which have really developed women's teams. Now, I will say about today's sides, Spain-Netherlands, one of the interesting things about this team is I've been tracking through the World Cup the relative development of their women's teams, and their women's teams are sort of around 20 in terms of their FIFA rankings. They're very comparable, and there's actually not a huge difference given, for example, Uruguay, which was ranked men 16, women below 116. That was the worst disparity in the entire tournament. Spain, you know, they drift around the top 10, and their women are around 20. That's not totally embarrassing, although, frankly, having played football in Spain outside of Barcelona, I can tell you that the best women footballers alive have got to be in Spain. I've never seen anything like it, playing the total football extreme with enormous flair and style, youth and energy and fitness level is incredible. So there's something wrong with the Spanish FA that they're not in the top five. So I know I've derailed the conversation.
Oh, no. This is great. Yeah. And we are now joined by Nick Green on the phone. He has a fantastic blog called 100% Soccer. He writes for the Daily Breeze, and he's really one of the best football journalists here in the United States. Nick Green, welcome to the People's Game.
Good to chat with you. A great day, huh?
It should be. And, you know, there's let me throw out my take on this and then throw it to Nick. I actually do think the Spanish will have the beautiful tight passing, but I think that Barcelona and Spain have one Achilles heel, which is the inability to shoot from distance. Xavi Alonso makes up for it, but compared to Wesley Sneijder, I would take his long-range shot over Xavi Alonso's any day. Certainly the Spanish, getting away from the total football question, the midfield dominance, have the better goalkeeper. Mm. I think that's clear. But I think that Wesley Sneijder's ability to shoot from distance, as well as Ian Robbins, in a sense, it could be that strength of the Dutch against the classical total football short passing strength of the Spanish. And I think it's a toss-up. Maybe a little tip to Spain. But what do you think, Nick?
I think you just set me up very well. That's a very plausible argument. I agree. I think both sides are great possession-oriented teams, but Spain's midfield, obviously with that Barcelona collection, has been getting better and better and better every game this tournament. I mean, let's not forget they started off with a loss. And all stay together. No team has ever won a World Cup that started off the tournament with a loss. So I guess we shouldn't forget that. But I agree with you. I think that I don't want to be overly simplistic and say it comes down to Wesley Sneijder versus David Villa, but I do think Sneijder is more influential in the Dutch team than Villa is for the Spanish team, and I do think in large measure, as we've already seen in this tournament, it's because of Snyder's ability to shoot from outside the box, and I agree. I think that may well be key, and Spain's ability to just pass it all the way into the goal may come to an end today, but I guess we'll see.
I do think one thing, again, this is getting further down the road, I do think if Spain gets ahead, I don't think the Dutch have anybody to bring on to, besides Van der Vaart.
No,
Van
der
Vaart can, but nobody, oh, that's right. Yeah, that's
Elia
good.
Is,
you're right.
Is,
but
is
I was thinking for
tasty,
for Van Persie right there to gobble up long-range shots. In fact, I've always thought Van Persie's a little bit of a weak link on this team, whereas, of course, the Spanish have two different strikers they could go to if they don't start Torres to really put the pressure right onto the Dutch goal face.
I want to ask Nick a kind of a writerly question.
Go for it.
Nick, you know, after a month of this, of watching, you know, dozens upon dozens of matches and these kinds of pre-match analyses, post-match, you know, picking over the carcass of the game, I was wondering, where are you in terms of, like, the writing process and these kinds of conversations? You know, do you feel – I feel like this whole experience has shattered any confidence that I had in sports talk as a kind of reasonable sort of scientific basis for understanding the game. I think, you know, the more attention I pay to these matches, the more mysterious the whole process seems to me.
And do you mean that in the context of the fact that we've had constant upsets and there seems to have been no clear favorite throughout the tournament? Is that what you mean?
I kind of do, yeah. I think that might be part of it. I think that this World Cup has you know, it has. It's not that it's defied logic, but it seemed that things have been walking on a kind of a knife's edge, and that games could have gone one way or another more often than not, and not necessarily in a suspenseful way, but in a rather kind of mysterious. I don't know why that team had no gas in its tank, and you know, no matter.
Or more importantly, why these great superstars that these you know, right, large right, companies
right,
build up
right,
as going
to
change
nowhere.
History
yeah, maybe that's
end up
it.
Never even showing up on the field on the day.
Well, I think all of those things is why, for me, this has made this the best World Cup tournament I've ever seen, actually. I've seen World Cups going back to 1970, at least portions of them. I was in the U.S. for, like, the 1982 one, so you could barely see any of it anyway here. But that's why I think it's been the best, most entertaining from a fan standpoint than I've ever been. Jennifer talks about the pundits, and we've seen that the best pundit in this World Cup is probably an octopus.
Or Nigel Boyle's students.
Paul. Pulpo Paul.
So I guess that really sums up Jennifer's point. But the other thing is that we've seen players that we expected to play really well in this tournament, like the Wayne Rooneys and the Lionel Messis, really didn't. And players came through that were perhaps not as expected to dominate as they did. And that's the beauty of the World Cup. Mm. That's why we play it anyway, and we don't sit around talking about it. And that's why I've really, really, just from a fan's perspective, enjoyed this World Cup more than any other.
Well, I actually think I'm going to be totally counter Jennifer's point here, is that I do think we've been able to discern what happened in the since the quarterfinals, I think, has been a defining moment in what we might see in international soccer for a long time, and it's not necessarily the best lesson, which is that even the creative sides, and in particular Holland, have restructured themselves around a much more defensive and pragmatic mode with two real pit bulls as attacking midfields in De Jong and Van Bommel. I mean, that's the defining theory that informs this Dutch side, and it has created, even when there have been multiple goals in games, leaving aside the third place match, it's not been on account of flow. Only one team in this tournament really was able to open up other teams, which was Germany, and everything else has sort of been squeezed. Goals have been sort of squeezed out. And I think that that shows that with the state of athleticism in the game right now, teams understand that they can be highly, highly competitive by clogging the midfield with a defensive tactic.
And actually, and as a counterpoint to that, we have yesterday's match, right? We have the bizarre third place match. I mean, after in a knockout tournament, you have this like kind of this phantom limb of a game,
right,
you know, that nobody ostensibly cares about. And what was that goal in that? Was it 3-2?
I love that game, by the way. It's always my favorite game generally in almost every World Cup.
And ending with the ball on the bar.
There was a great kind of poetic justice moment where Forlan dinged it, the ball, to hit the top. I think it hit the top of the top, just as had happened with Guyan, at the end of the Ghana-Uruguay match.
But all that having said, Germany's first two goals were wretched mistakes by the went back to the Robert
That's
Green
right.
effect.
That's
wretched
right.
effect
bad,
goals.
Bad goal, goalkeeping. Yeah. Uruguay wins that game 3-1, if not for the goalkeeper.
Right. Yeah, it's terrible.
Well, I just want to point out, I was the group of death in the U-20 Women's World Cup, which is starting this week on July 13th. It's England, Nigeria, Mexico, Japan, and I for those of you who are interested in football, this is the Nigerian women's squad is a revelation. I was glued to my laptop watching live streaming games with no commentary, listening to ambient sound as I watched Nigeria really provide some of the best competition to Germany and Brazil. This is the team that in my opinion just seems to get the short end of the stick and eat all of their group assignments. So if you can find some live streaming sites as channeling some of the European sports stations, because they will actually broadcast this to their credit. So England, Nigeria, Mexico, Japan, that's a group for you for speed.
This is Nigeria. Yeah. So Nigeria has the Ivory Coast curse.
For people that don't follow football quite as addictively as I do, they don't recognize that the World Cup senior men's, the one that everyone's focusing on today, is just one of many, 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 many tournaments that happen regularly, at least one major tournament every year, whether it's the men starting under 17, under 20, under 23, which is also known as the Olympics, and then you've got the senior. Mm-hmm. And so if you found yourself being very, drawn to world soccer during this tournament, you need not go through withdrawals. You can start, as Jennifer's been pointing out quite well, start watching another major tournament, the under 20 women, which will be in Germany.
Well, now that we have Nick on the phone, and I suppose we've covered what's going to be going on in the game, I want to actually talk with Nick and Jennifer. And what we'll do is we'll maybe hold on to Nick for a few minutes, then we'll hear from Simon Cooper. He goes straight into the Spanish side and the Dutch side. We'll hear those clips from the interview with Simon Cooper. But Nick and Jennifer, I've followed their work on the web, and one of the great strengths is this sport in Southern California. And so, Nick, you've watched these games around at many places. What has your experience been in terms of the World Cup in Southern California society in 2010?
Well, that's another reason I've enjoyed this World Cup more than any other I've ever seen. Just being able to walk around this town and walk around it like it's a planet, and it's easily reachable, and you can just watch games with various nationalities and various ethnic groups and live and die with them. I mean, Alpine Village, which is a Bavarian-themed bar and restaurant near Torrance, the crowds have grown incredibly. When the tournament started, there was just a sort of a handful of us watching at 4:30 in the morning, sort of a darkened bar. And by the end of it, the place was packed, absolutely packed. Even for the third-place game, it was really busy yesterday. And that is just telling me that more than any other World Cup tournament I've ever seen, it's connecting with Southern Californians, and not only those of different ethnicities and nationalities you would expect would enjoy the game from their homeland, but also by Americans. It's been really amazing to me to just walk into work and have somebody I had no clue was a soccer fan or even paid attention to my blog or my column or anything saying, wow, what a game this morning. Can you believe it? It was just very, very strange, and that happened more this time than any other World Cup ever, and being in L.A. for a World Cup, I think, has been the next best thing to being in South Africa.
Yeah. I ditto to everything that Nick has said, and to that I will add a growing, you know, a sense of melancholy, you know, that our region should be so great at watching it and our city should be so lame at supporting the playing of it. Listening to Daniel Morales speak on Friday's interview in the People's Game about, you know, this is a guy who's been organizing community-based soccer practically free for the most underserved population in the city, you know, and to learn that the city was actually giving him fewer hours rather than more, you know, at a time of the year when more, you know, kids are out of school, they need something to do. It made me sad, and I've also been having conversations with young players that I know through my own work organizing a league. Guys who are, you know, in their early 20s who do nothing but play the sport. And, you know, a common thread within their immediate friend circle, guys who are like 18, 19, you know, up to about 25, is, you know, they're uninsured. And so everybody has someone, a friend, who doesn't play anymore because they tore their ACL or they broke a bone and they can't afford to have the screws or the plate removed from their bone. They can't afford to get the ACL injury fixed. And after watching this Nike ad where people are sort of thanking the guys for playing like Americans, it's like a little viral video where, you know, a bunch of boy players thank the U.S. men's national team for playing like Americans. I've been thinking, well, what makes an American player? And it's sad to say the absence of health insurance is absolutely one of the things that defines the lives of young athletes, right? And that is not an overstatement to say that, because it is a huge concern. You get injured and you have not the means to have it treated, but you certainly don't have the means to get the rehab that an ambitious athlete would deserve. And I think that's a crying shame. So this has been on my mind a lot lately, because when you watch these games being played at this level, you immediately start thinking of the guys that you play with, the women that you play with, and the shades of Messi, the shades of Forlan, you know, of Howard, right? Like you see that in your friends, and to see that ability to, halted by the absence of support for them as athletes and as people, it's just a crying shame. So that's been what's been on my mind the past couple of days. Sorry, it's a downer.
And you know what's interesting is it's Simon Cooper's book, and we don't actually get into this in the interview with Cooper, but this is I'll throw to Nick in a second. He actually makes the point that if you look at global sports and global team sports, football's analog is rugby. American football's analog is rugby, right? Baseball's is cricket. Basketball's basketball everywhere, and soccer everywhere. So this great fear that at least the two classically most popular American sports have of soccer is really quite misplaced. He argues that those other two sports will survive. I'd argue that gridiron football might be a little bit more, should be more fearful of soccer. There's this odd paradox that MLS takes place in the summer, and so it could bite into baseball's audience. But generally, the bat and ball, you know, go to station-to-station games like cricket and baseball are one thing, and he thinks that they'll actually coexist very well. And along those lines, Nick, I mean, my impression, though, is that when you look at, if you could take an index of passion crossed with interest, right? So there's general interest, but then you throw passion into the pool. I would argue that football is already the most popular sport in Southern California. I mean, if you take all the residents of Southern California.
Oh, absolutely. Agree, 100%. I think that's something that generally flies under the radar of much of the mainstream media, much of whom probably not, ironically, have been laid off and aren't working in the industry anymore. I don't think it's any coincidence that soccer is covered best, I think, on the internet and through blogs.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the very democratic element, the internet. And where does the people's game go? Goes to the internet. Doesn't go to a place that is controlled by large corporations who decide what to write about and therefore tell you what to think about. So from that sense, I really agree with you. You know, Mexico is probably the most popular national team in Southern California, and we've got club teams like Club America and CD Guadalajara. They're more popular, the case has been made, than the Dodgers. It's just that general society doesn't recognize it. But on the other hand, I don't want to set up a American football versus soccer kind of mentality either. I think the American sports landscape is unlike that of any elsewhere in the world, and I think it's proven that all these different sports can sort of sit side by side and you can enjoy them individually for what they are. At least I hope we can.
You know, if I can make a quick point, I see where, in my opinion, I see that the NFL is going to end up being more like NASCAR. Because you think of NASCAR, here's an incredibly popular spectator sport, but not everyone can afford a $50,000 race car and $1 million to have a pit crew and all this, and it's all sponsored by companies and they slather their stickers everywhere. And football, American football, is, in my opinion, there's going to be smaller and smaller participation from your average kid in the street, and more these like superhuman steroid guys are going to end up playing in front of television cameras more and more, and it'll just end up being more circus than sport, in my opinion. That's where I sort of see it going. I don't think it's ever going to disappear, and I think it's part of the American fiber. I certainly enjoy my NFL Sundays, but it's the idea that if there's any kind of sandlot football games going on and that all these schools have to cut the budgets, and football's being the first one that goes because of how much money it costs, the amount of male players and Title IX requiring equality. It's a dinosaur in terms of participation, but I don't see it going away as a spectacle.
I just want to point out that the U.S. women, that there's that kind of, I think they're like an unofficial U.S. women's national football, as in gridiron football team, just won the world women's football championship in Sweden last week.
Okay.
Just by FYI.
I imagine they were favored. The sports really only played here. Go ahead, Nick.
I was just going to say, I think it's a mistake to equate participation in sport with popularity of the professional game in any sport. I think we've seen that myth laid to rest in soccer, and I think we've seen it in sports like Formula One. I know we all drive cars, but we don't all drive Formula One cars, and Formula One is the second most popular global sport on television after soccer, and Americans don't realize that either. So I don't think it necessarily follows that just because you play it, you're going to love to watch it. In fact, depressingly, in our society, with growing obesity and people sitting around on their butts all the time, I really think that sports like the NFL are actually elevated in stature by people not playing them. Because it becomes of a kind of a gladiatorial spectacle,
right,
where this fat guy is sitting on his couch Sunday after Sunday, watching these guys do something he can only dream of doing and is physically incapable of doing, but he's got the money to be able to, pay for them to do it for himself, and it becomes just a sort of scary commentary on society. And I just see sports like the NFL becoming popular precisely because people can't play them.
Yeah, there was a really great article a while ago in the New Yorker about Michael Vick. And the ways in which, given the horrible story of his involvement with dogs and fighting, but the way in which he's in essence kind of scapegoated for a whole ethos that evolves around the NFL in particular, the story actually turns from the story of like Michael Vick to the story like what it is that we ask of these young men and what they do with their bodies and what. You know, we're in essence watching a blood sport to a certain degree, given the terrible, terrible head injuries, the joint injuries. That a lot of these men have crippling pain and suffer from degenerative mental disorders because of the repeated trauma to their bodies. There's a real serious kind of crisis happening and unfolding around the sport, and the players themselves are leading this in their own fight to actually have their disabilities recognized as injuries that they picked up while playing for the NFL and in their battles with the players' union and the league.
No, it's true. There, the one guy finally was an offensive guard. People don't realize that they come out of the down position, just bam, straight on in the center of their head, helmet to helmet against the guys up against them. They're getting all sorts of brain injuries. Nick Green, we're going to have to let you go in a moment, but I suppose we are facing this fantastic match right now between Holland and Spain. We're about less than 2 hours away from kickoff. Would you perhaps tender a prediction?
Yes, 2-1, Holland over Spain. David Villa and Snyder both score, share the Golden Boot. Mm. Snyder is more influential than I say than Villa, and Van Bommel breaks up the Spain's vaunted passing midfield to such a degree that they don't have the attacking momentum like the Dutch do.
And where are you watching the match today?
I will be just walking down to my local watering hole, the Red Car Brewery and Restaurant in Old Torrance. It's opening early. Serves a fine breakfast burrito. Has both a lovely porter and red on tap for later in the morning. So if anybody's listening and care to join me, that's where I'll be.
Well, thank you, Nick. This is Fernando. I just want to I agree with you totally. I think Mark Van Bommel and De Jong in the midfield are going to have to stop Xavi and both Iniesta. These are two guys that are – Van Bommel and De Jong are two players that are just very uncompromising. Just have to, these are the type of guys that will probably – send these two guys into early retirement if they have to. And I think I might add Van Persie's scores tonight. I think he's due tonight.
Well, Nick Green, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game. By the way, folks, The People's Game will be back for its final installment on air tomorrow in the 4 o'clock hour. So Nick will probably give you a call and check in with you then. Your reflections on the match, and enjoy the match today.
You too, guys.
Thank you so much. Well, this is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky. This is KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM. You've probably caught on that this is KPFK's coverage of the 2010 World Cup. We got a lot of stuff to cover in the last 25 minutes, but not the for me, the most important thing is to say happy birthday to my three-year-old daughter, Millie. Okay, happy birthday, Millie. They scheduled the World Cup final on her birthday, the two most important events in the world. So, folks, what we're going to do the rest of this time is we're going to hear a couple clips right now from Simon Cooper, and he's going to talk about the Spanish side first, and then he's going to talk about the Dutch side. So we're going to hear from Simon Cooper. Then when we come back, we're going to get, again, reflections on the game. We're also going to get reflections on why we think everybody in the world pays attention to this at this historical moment. So right now, Simon Cooper, author of Soccer Against the Enemy and Soccernomics, from an interview done yesterday. In the relationship between Dutch football, Dutch total football, FC Barcelona, the Spanish side, and of course the Dutch national side squaring off in the finals. But even before we get there, I suppose we should clarify that for people who aren't that familiar, again, with the club sides who are listening, this Spanish side, I really see its central core to an overwhelming degree to be from FC Barcelona, right? You have, even though Xavi Alonso and Sergio Ramos play for Real Madrid, with Xavi and Iniesta, Puyol and Pique, David Villa is joining the club, so maybe he doesn't really count. But with those four players, I really see this Spanish side as an extension of the style of play that FC Barcelona has used in recent years. And in many respects, it's just sort of additions to that core. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, I see it as a largely FC Barcelona team. I agree that the dominant players who set the style are made in Barcelona. But I'd go further and I'd say that it's a style made in Holland originally.
Right.
Because Johan Cruyff is the father of Dutch soccer, came to Barcelona with the other father of Dutch soccer, Venus Michels, at the start of the 70s. And they taught the Spanish Dutch passing total football. And when Cruyff came back as manager to Barcelona in the late 80s, he reinstituted that. Later they had a succession of Dutch coaches. And so it's very, very much become a Dutch club in its philosophy. Soccer is about passing, about positioning, about where do I stand. It's not about physique or about speed or about passion. It's like soccer is a kind of chess, not soccer is a kind of wrestling. And so the Barcelona style, which has become the Spanish style, was originally the Dutch style. And so Holland-Spain tomorrow is, in a sense, Holland versus Holland. And the irony is that the Spaniards are more Dutch in their style of play now than the Dutch are.
Hello, and that was Simon Cooper, who was talking about the Spanish side. And right now we're going to go to his clip about the Dutch side. Now, as you'll hear, he is more or less a Dutch partisan. And this is very interesting reflection because he's talking about, given the fact that the Dutch do see themselves as the sort of national soccer tradition that are the authors of this side, there's been a lot of discourse in the Dutch media about what this Dutch team means, how they're doing, what their expectations are. I thought this was a very dramatic segment from the interview with Simon Cooper. What do you make of the current Dutch side? Because there's been much criticism from the domestic press in Holland that even though they've reached the final, especially in the earlier part of the tournament, I can only imagine that the criticism has died down now that they've reached the final for the third time in the national side's history of the World Cup. What do you make of the team in terms of the two holding defensive midfielders, a somewhat more conservative approach, a more pragmatic approach? What's your sense of the style of play they're using, and is it a corruption of total football?
I mean, people have been noting that Holland now play like Germany and Germany play more like Holland. And so we've lost the moral superiority in soccer that we always had. You know, we played the peaceful game, other people didn't, and they cheated. And so although we lost, we went home the moral victors. That's largely gone. And even in Euro 2008, we played the most beautiful football for two games. Holland demolished Italy and France. Mm. And then we went out early. So the tradition of glorious defeats extends until 2008. So that's really the founding tradition of Dutch soccer, glorious defeat, beginning in 1974.
Right.
And after 2008, people said, you know, we've kind of had enough of losing. It would be nice to have an inglorious victory. And the whole philosophy of this side is inglorious victory. We kick, we defend, we punt the ball out of defense. We hope that Arjen Robben, our resident genius, will have one moment of inspiration. So, yeah, I mean, in some ways, the tradition has been debased. But there is a lot still in the tradition that you still see that Linus Michels, if he returned, you know, from heaven, he would recognize a lot. There's we pass more intelligent than anyone else. We understand positioning better than anyone else. I say better than anyone else except Spain, I should say. Mm. And so the idea that soccer is largely passing and positioning still survives, but now Holland do it from a defensive position rather than by trying to have the ball and dominate games.
And this is Alan Minsky. That is an interview I did with Simon Cooper, who is basically the sports stringer for the Financial Times. He is the author of two very influential books on soccer back in the 90s, Soccer Against the Enemy, and the recent book, Soccernomics. In a moment, we'll hear a clip about the book Soccernomics, but I want to maybe talk with the team here a little bit about what we just heard from him. But first of all, let me say, in the interview, I asked him if he ever interviewed Johan Cruyff. Johan Cruyff, who in many respects is sitting in the center of the world right now, as he has been highly influential in the generation of Dutch soccer and Spanish soccer, and is renowned as a very difficult interview and a very sort of difficult man. Cooper tells a very interesting anecdote about his direct experiences with Johan Cruyff in the interview, and you can find the whole interview at www.thepeoplesgame.org. Right now it's the top interview on the website. About what he talks about, I think that really one of the keys of this match is not just the fact of the holding Dutch midfielders, but the fact that they're holding Dutch midfielders who maybe really know how to defend against total football players and people who practice it really brilliantly. Because all of their careers, right, Van Bommel and De Jong and the four Dutch defenders will have gone up against really great practitioners of this style. Maybe not as great as Xavi and Iniesta, but you would think that these guys will know the spacing and what they have to contend with. This is maybe what I think is a little bit the secret weapon that Holland has. But, of course, touche to Jennifer, I could be completely wrong. It could be 8-6 right. to nothing Spain.
Well, I'm going to say if you want to see an open attacking, flowing total football game, then you should see Brazil take the field in the Women's U-20s World Cup Championship. They will put everything on the table, and you will see all of their style, their team unity. You'll see attacking defenders. Basically, in the women's game, that's the side that I think actually has more of that spirit than anyone else. So back to the guys.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Also, I wanted to add, like you were mentioning, Van Bommel and De Jong and even Van Bronckhorst are going to be keys to these are right. And Van Bommel and Bronckhorst both played in Barcelona, so they're very know the game. They know the way that Xavi and Iniesta both play. And it's going to be not only on them to defend, but also they have the talent and skills to go up and like as Gio proved a couple of days ago when he scored that goal against Uruguay, that they can go up and score goals. Even Van Bommel, he's doing it not so much at Bayern Munich, but when he was at Barcelona, he was the type of player that would play in the midfielder role.
I'm going to make one comment, which is my fear for the Dutch side. Mm. And my fear for the Dutch side is an early red card.
Yes.
Because both De Jong and Van Bommel have been lucky to not have a red card so far this tournament. And so if that happens, this game gets turned on its head easy.
Well, again, but part of the shtick with those guys is they're such professionals that they sort of know how to aggressively just barrel into people and not even get yellows.
And I was going to say that that issue is as likely to go against Spain as it is against the Netherlands, because I can see them provoking the Spanish players with their kind of aggression, you know, like a call. Say, for example, you know, you get a tackle that you feel should be a red and it's a yellow or not even a card. That's often when players lose their heads and when they earn a red card and find themselves off the field. Though I will say the Spanish players are pros, absolute pros. Right. And so I think we're going to see a lot of, I don't want to say theatrics exactly, but I think we're going to see some manipulation around these kinds of issues on a micro level. So those of us who play know that side of the game well, there's going to be a lot of interesting subterranean drama.
I think it's fair to say that the point you just made was probably the most important single fact about the Brazil-Holland match. I mean, right off the bat, Brazil was thrown off their game. They were out of their heads. They were ticked off, in particular, at De Jong and Van Bommel. They got under their skin in exactly the same way. I actually think, though, that the core total footballers, FC Barcelona, and this also extends to Wenger at Arsenal, these guys are so familiar, they actually don't get very flustered. You very rarely see the central midfield for Arsenal or Barcelona. I mean, Xavi and Iniesta, they're not divers. They just jump right back up.
And they're also not prima donnas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's something that has been, I don't know what they do at Barcelona, whether it's the water, or I don't know, but these guys, I mean, you look at Messi, who could be even greater if he had a little more, you know,
we all know that
a little more something.
A little bit of politics here. We haven't done a lot of politics. We'll get to that soon here on the People's Game.
Okay.
But, you know, FC Barcelona, we haven't mentioned this at all. And with Cooper, he doesn't mention it. And great interview with Cooper. People should check that out. But for people who don't know, FC Barcelona, every damn club in the world has an advertising slogan across their chest. Well, FC Barcelona, from the great progressive tradition in Catalonia and in Barcelona, they not only do not take money for their chest, they have UNICEF on their chest, and they give money to UNICEF. So it may be just that the angelic countenance of the people who go through there, the good karma, that's why they're so damn.
I'm sorry to derail things again. Well, actually, I'm not at all sorry. By the way, FC Gold Pride, which is the top WPS team, which fields some of the best female players in the universe, including Her Majesty Marta, they take the field at 6 p.m. Eastern time against Washington Freedom, and I believe that's actually on the Fox Soccer Channel. So check it out.
Awesome.
And right now what we're going to do is we're going to hear the third and final clip we're going to play from the interview with Simon Cooper, and this is about his book Soccernomics. It's I wanted to play this sort of last of the clips from Cooper, and we'll come back and we'll talk about the state of football in the world, because this is a book that could be hugely influential. In fact, at the beginning of the book, talks about writing about American baseball and the ways in which sort of a scientific analysis revolutionized the game of baseball in the 80s and 90s. Well, now they're trying to do the same thing with soccer. It's a co-authored book by Simon Cooper. It's called Soccernomics. And let's hear the part of the interview where we introduce the subject of the book Soccernomics. So let's turn now directly to Soccernomics, a fascinating book. And before we talk about how it looked at the World Cup and provided some prognostication and how then things turned out, fitting the thesis or not. There are two things about the book I want to talk about with you to start. One is the general thesis of it, but secondarily, this notion, and you cite at the beginning of the book, the way that American baseball was transformed as a sort of science of looking at the game grew into vogue starting in the late 80s into the 90s, and now it's extremely influential, and that is just starting to take place in soccer, and that this book is sort of blazing a path in that respect. The general thesis, and then how you think that if this kind of thinking could take off, it could transform the sport.
I mean, the general idea was, yes, soccer has been run on gut and on tradition, and on the way, this is the way we've always done it, and it's run by men whose claim to run the game is that they played it when they were kids and played it well, and therefore they're now allowed to run clubs. And we said, you know, and people then talk about this in bars and say this coach is bad and the team lost because the coach is bad. And we said, well, we're going to take all this traditional thinking and test it against cold, hard data and see what we come up with. And so, for example, one thing we found is that coaches are much less important than people think, because players' wages determine almost everything. And it was only while we'd begun writing Soccernomics that I read Moneyball, so it was post-facto. Mm. But I did read it and think, wow, Billy Beane, who I've since got in contact with, who's a soccer fan, Billy Beane was trying to think about baseball in the same way that we are trying to think about soccer, sort of derive from Mars, if you like, take a cold, hard look at the game from the outside and say, this doesn't make sense.
That is an interview with Simon Cooper about the state of contemporary soccer and the ways that a science of soccer is just developing and can develop in the way it did in baseball to transform the sport. Yeah, it's a very interesting book. I do think relative to what we saw in baseball in the 80s and 90s, this is very embryonic. There are a lot of ideas and theses and directions that could be taken up in the book that are investigated by Simon Cooper and his co-author. His name, by the way, is K-U-P-E-R, so that's how, if you want to find his work. Very interesting and creative journalist about global football. So Jennifer Doyle just told me, and I think this is proof of the sort of point maybe I want to focus on in the next 8 minutes, that there's an event happening today in which most of the world is going to pay attention to it like they do no other event. Well, Paris and Nicky Hilton are at the game. So, you know, obviously these great signifiers of where it's at in the world.
Of culture, really.
Nicky Hilton just tweeted that it just got to the finals. The atmosphere is great.
There we go.
As opposed to what was she expecting?
Well, guys, I want to just throw it around the round table right now. And, you know, we've done this show here on KPFK. We've taken a unique angle on the World Cup. We've spoken about the games on the field, and we've also spoken about the cultural, social, political, and economic subtext of the most popular cultural event in the world. You know, Pablo, by the way, is a filmmaker whose film Gringos at the Gate about the USA and Mexico soccer rivalry. Looks at, again, these subtexts within that. And as you can imagine, Southern California is very much ground zero. So why do you think at this point in history, football in particular, but a particular spectacle sport, is clearly the most popular? I mean, you know, rock music, global music is in crisis. Soccer at this stage of neoliberal capitalism is now bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, I mean, for me, it goes back to being very young and having a multicultural background, parents who are immigrants, and knowing that whether I went to Argentina, Chile, Holland, Spain, anywhere I had family, there was one thing for sure that we could talk about, and that was football. We all had that as a common language. There's mathematics, there's music, and there's football. Those are in my opinion, the three international languages. If you know them, you can talk to almost anybody that has the shared interest. Mm. And that's the glue that holds this world spectacle together. Outside of the millionaires on the field, outside of the amazing camera work, outside of all the things that are making this particular, and just also the fact that, you know, I think that the world football, like everything else in the world, is getting relatively equal. Mm. It's not dominated just by Northern Europeans and South Americans anymore. And so that makes it more exciting because everybody everywhere can have a ball, two cones, and someone on the street who thinks that they should be playing professionally. And that's why everybody wants to watch. And there's something to love in that, in my opinion. It's the true internationalist event.
Yeah, and certainly in international language, and I think one of the things I thought about a lot, and it wasn't brought out too much because we're overwhelmed by this incredible, you know, media spectacle of the World Cup, is it is certainly among young men and beginning to spread among young women.
Not beginning. Women have played soccer since men have been playing soccer. It has been actively suppressed by national football associations around the world. Thank you to the English FA's 1929 ban against women playing soccer.
It might be the craft that is developed in people's youth more now than any other craft in the world. So it isn't entirely, and this goes to your point about gridiron football earlier, it's not entirely an alienating relationship. We are looking at something that so many people in the world do, and I think it's almost universal among young men in the world to play football at some level. So there is that element of connection when you watch Cristiano Ronaldo. Well, not today. When you watch the players out on the field, it's very easy to project yourself because you played the game. Fernando, your thoughts?
Along the same lines as Pablo, it's, you know, it's a very simple game. It's a kid's game, obviously. It's a game that you can just, you just need a ball or something that you can kick or that bounces or something that's made into a ball and you can just play it anywhere, which is the same reason that the game was able to spread throughout the world when the English exported it. Over 100 years ago, and adding to that, it is very beautiful to watch, you know, players, you know, with the ball glued to their feet and like weave through and dribble. And it is a ballet, and it's something that people can relate to just watching it or being on the pitch while you're playing or watching, you know, your kids play. It's something that's very beautiful. And because of that, I think it infects people with this passion to want to watch it, want to play it. And I think that's why and then you get, you know, FIFA involved and you get, you know, media and you get conglomerates and you get money. And here we are, it's 2010, about an hour high for the World Cup, and there's 2 billion people waiting to watch this thing.
That's Fernando Romero and Jennifer Doyle.
Yeah, I think since I started blogging about soccer at fromaleftwing.blogspot.com.
Great site.
Very modest, Jennifer.
I've been thinking about the tension between this kind of our desire to sort of see a kind of a universal connection through the game, which is certainly something that is supported through the game's simplicity. In fact, that, you know, you can play this game with twine, a plastic bag, right, and a tiny bit of space. Then, you know, we have something like the World Cup, right, as a spectacle, you know, from which all of the specificity of local practices of football must be excluded, you know, in order for the teams to actually be able to compete according to these same sorts of rules and on, you know, that I go back to thinking about, say, for example, the Indian national team's participation in international competition. And when international competition between national football teams started, the, you know, Indian national team came to these tournaments and played in bare feet. And this was a big deal the moment when they were actually told, you must play in shoes. And, I mean, it seems sort of funny, but when you look at it, you're talking about athletes who had grown up playing in their bare feet, and it was part of their style and their identity as a national team. And the rule that you had to wear shoes was introduced, that had a big impact on the team's performance. Playing in bare feet would give them weird, unanticipated advantages according to like the field conditions and the like, and disadvantages. I think wet weather is actually a real disaster for them. You know, looking at little things like this, where you see like FIFA, where FIFA, we have to regulate this game and we have to make everybody play the same way and have the same, the illusion that these teams have the same resources, at least there for spectators and the like. So I've become really interested in the World Cup as a spectacle around which the specificity of national cultures, of regional cultures within those nations, actually is constantly being managed. And one of the big issues around this that we see now is in relation to the women's game and FIFA's support of a local referee's decision in a youth match in Quebec 2 years ago to bar a girl from participating in a tournament because she was wearing a headscarf, which was perfectly fine in terms of the safety of the play. Their decision to support that has led now to the exclusion of the Iranian women's team from an international competition and open debate around the world in relationship to youth games for Muslim women athletes and also for young Sikh men, teenage boys who wear a kind of turban styled for athletic play, which is very common. We see that in cricket. You know, but as FIFA tries to make everybody look the same, right, they have very real impacts on local footballing cultures. And so this is the kind of thing that the World Cup brings out. And I want to say, actually, Social Text, an interesting Marxist journal, has just published a dossier of writing. I have a piece in that. It's socialtextjournal.org. And so for those looking for kind of academic perspectives on these things, it's not academic writing. It's really meant for a broader audience. But I'm one of, I think, 6 or 7 scholars who are talking about the meaning of the World Cup, where we talk about these issues.
And website one more time, Social Text.
Socialtextjournal.org.
And I don't mean to confuse people. There's also a great journal out there that we've not mentioned often on the show, only a couple times, called Soccer and Society. We only have a couple minutes left, and in the last minute, at 58-59, let's go around quickly and stick our necks on the line and get predictions, including on the under-20 game. The game going on at 3 p.m. on Fox Soccer Channel. So I have a minute here, and I suppose what I want to say is that I want to throw people a little bit to the interview that we did with David Goldblatt that's on peoplesgame.org. That was the one I was very happy with, looking at these general themes. I think if you look at global soccer, I think there are two things that really stand out, which is that the game really took off in the post-Cold War period with the expansion of globalization, neoliberalization, not in terms of who was playing it. Just as many parts of the world were playing it then as are now, maybe a few places it has expanded, and significant places like the USA. But what happened is the global media spectacle really took off in the late 90s. The premiership was formed in England. Murdoch got into it. The satellite TVs were going up right at the end of the Cold War. And I do think at this hour of the history of the game, There are now fewer sort of expressions of left, progressive, radical people's solidarity in the game than there used to be. It was very associated with the working classes to a degree that it no longer is, and working class solidarity. So I do think it's important maybe that people should think about soccer as a place where the world collects. And if you want a progressive, socially just society, the people are there. Let's figure strategies to sort of reintroduce that and then take it from there. And yes, the it is right now dominated by global financial capital. And even in the era when there's a huge global financial crisis, soccer is just on the up and up and up in terms of how much money is being poured into it. So I see it as a space of sort of macroeconomic contestation. But right now, in all honesty, the side that's winning elsewhere is winning in soccer, too. Anyway, so this is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
This is Pablo Morales.
Fernando Romero.
And Jennifer Doyle.
We have 30 seconds left. I have said so many things across the hour that I think Holland has in their back pocket to win this game. I still think Spain is going to win. That's my prediction. Yours, Pablo?
No, it's definitely heart-head. You know, heart says Holland, head says Spain.
Holland, 2-1.
I have absolutely no idea.
There we go. A great consistency across the hour, except for the fact that that only pertains to soccer prognostication on Jennifer's behalf. This is KPFK Radio. This is the People's Game. We'll be back tomorrow in the 4 p.m. hour for our People's Game wrap-up and World Cup wrap-up. Enjoy the game, everybody out there today. Up next is Blaise Bompain with World Focus and Alternative Radio. We'll be back at 9 a.m. on Sunday next week.